Today is Wednesday, March 15th. We're going to be working on respiratory physiology today. Okay, about midway down page 74, function of the respiratory system, something we learn early on in life is to exchange blood gases. So we're going to talk more detail about how that happens to take place. We're going to talk about diffusion and the transport of those gases as we move through this chapter today. We know the respiratory system must work with the cardiovascular system. The cardiovascular system is the one that transports these blood gases in arteries and capillaries, of course doing the exchange there and then bringing that blood back to the lungs in those veins. So the whole basic reason for breathing is because of cellular respiration. And you may recall that cellular respiration takes place in your mitochondria. The mitochondria make quite important energy molecule.
ATP.
ATP, right. So in order to make ATP, we require oxygen, and as a waste product, we produce carbon dioxide. So when we think about breathing, we actually kind of have to think small picture here. The whole purpose of breathing is to give those mitochondria the oxygen they need to make aerobic respiration happen, and of course to carry off that excess CO2. So that's kind of what we're thinking about here in terms of respiratory system. In terms of respiratory functions, there's four big jobs. The first one is called pulmonary ventilation. This is just a fancy word that means breathing. Okay, so pulmonary ventilation is breathing, inhalation, and exhalation. We're going to talk more about external respiration later in this chapter, but for now we'll just simply define it as a gas exchange. So where does external respiration take place? Comes from the outside, right. So it comes in from the outside world. The first opportunity for gas exchange is in your lungs. Where specifically?
Alveoli.
Alveoli, good. What blood vessels pick up those gases? Good. Pulmonary capillaries. And of course, we get rid of CO2 in the same location. So external respiration occurs in your lungs, at your pulmonaries, capillaries, and alveoli. That gas exchange allows us to move oxygen into our bloodstream and unload CO2 and move it out of our bloodstream. Respiratory gas transport, well, we've done that. That's how you move blood through the arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules, and veins. And of course, that process of moving blood gases around your body is critical for delivery of oxygen to our cells and tissues and to pick up that CO2. Finally, when you get to those systemic capillaries all over your body, we perform internal respiration. Now, here's a catch. How will you keep straight external respiration, which is a gas exchange, from internal respiration, which is also a gas exchange? Where do they take place?
Outside the body and inside the body.
Yep. This is in the outside, where the outside world comes in, the lungs and the alveoli perform gas exchange for external respiration. Where does internal respiration occur?
It comes to your
cells and tissues. Cells and tissues, good. So in our systemic capillaries all over our body, that's where we perform this internal respiration. So we'll come back and talk more about the loading and unloading issues associated with these gas exchanges. For now, I'd like to flip on over to page 75 and talk with you about breathing. This is pulmonary ventilation. Pulmonary ventilation simply means to move air in and out of your lungs, and it involves inhalation and exhalation. We also call inhalation inspiration, and we also call exhalation expiration. I don't know about that word. It makes me feel like I'm on my last breath, you know? You just expired. You're done. Real technically, it means that you just breathed air out, but, you know, kind of has a different connotation to us. So in order to appreciate how we breathe, we got to appreciate a little bit of physics. So physics laws include this one here called Boyle's Law. And Boyle's Law is going to demonstrate the relationship between pressure and volume. So what we have to think about is our thoracic cavity. So let's build a thoracic cavity for just a moment. We've got a set of muscles that form between your ribs. And what are those muscles called?
Intercostal.
Intercostal muscles, good. We've also got a muscle that is under the base of our lungs. That muscle is?
Diaphragm.
Good. So we're just going to use this like a box. And of course, the trachea leads off the top side here. And that really gives us, excuse me, a closed box that we can deal with, a volume of space that we're going to work with. So when we think about the air in your lungs has to be confined by the walls, the intercostals on the sides, the diaphragm on the bottom. When you decide to breathe in, you can consciously make your rib cage flare out, and you can make your diaphragm flatten down. What happened to the volume between my top picture and my bottom picture? I got more volume, right? I got more space there. So I'm going to say that my volume increased with this bottom picture. Maybe I didn't change the amount of air in my lungs, but I just gave my air more space to spread out. So we say that the pressure inside our lungs will then
decrease.
Yeah, so the pressure in here goes down. Okay. So this is Boyle's law. It depends on two variables, pressure and volume, and they are inversely proportional. What does it mean to be inversely proportional?
Opposites.
Opposites, right. One variable goes up, the other one must go down. So when we think about inhalation, we consciously, or even subconsciously, can make our rib cage flare, we can push our diaphragms down, that increases the volume inside our thoracic cavities, and we know the pressure is inverse, so it will decrease inside our lungs. Well, that's going to be the driving force behind inhalation. This top picture we can use as exhalation. We can say that we have a decreased volume up there, and if you have a smaller space for all the air in your lungs, what happens to the pressure? Yeah, pressure increases or goes up. Okay. So we'll tie that picture in with exhalation. Okay, so to appreciate Boyle's law is to say that there are two variables, pressure and volume, and those volumes and pressures are inversely proportional, meaning when one goes up, the other automatically goes down. That's going to be the driving factor behind how we breathe. Okay, so the next thing I need to introduce to you are three pressures. They're about halfway down your page. The first one there is called atmospheric pressure. And an atmospheric pressure is what's around your body. It's the air that you're breathing in at this moment. You'll notice 760 millimeters mercury is atmospheric pressure at sea level. Okay, and so we call that value 1 atm, which is 1 atmosphere. Now, inside your body, you've got a couple of pressures. You've got intrapulmonary pressure, and you've got intrapleural pressure. Okay, so let's talk about the difference between intrapulmonary and intrapleural pressures. When we talked about the pleura on Monday, where are the pleura located? Outside the lungs, good. So let's draw another rib cage. Let's put our diaphragm down below. And we're going to talk about the pleura as being two layers anchored to that diaphragm and anchored to the thoracic cavity wall. So there is a set of pleura that is outermost, and there is a set of pleura that are innermost. Do you know the name of the outermost pleural layer? Parietal, good. And the innermost one? Visceral, good. Now, there is a bit of space between my visceral and parietal pleura. It's actually filled with a fluid known as what?
Serous
fluid, good. Now, that pressure, intrapleural pressure, is situated in that pleural space where you've got the serous fluid. So when you're talking about intrapleural pressure, you're technically referring to the pressure between your visceral pleura and your outermost parietal pleura. So I'm just going to make a note here that that's where we find our intrapleural pressure. Okay, so V for visceral and P for parietal. That intrapleural pressure is the pressure between those two layers. we have a second pressure. It's called intrapulmonary pressure. That intrapulmonary pressure should be inside the what? Inside the lungs. Good. So intrapulmonary pressure is in the alveoli. You may notice on your worksheet, almost dead center of the page, it says there, the intrapleural pressure must remain negative, and if it ever becomes equal to atmospheric pressure, we lose lung, you know, inflation, the lungs will collapse, and the word atelectasis there reminds us that lungs collapse when that intrapleural pressure ever becomes greater than or equal to atmospheric pressure. So this pressure here between your two pleural layers must always remain less than or negative to your atmospheric pressure. So that's how your lungs stay inflated. Got to keep that pressure negative to or less than atmospheric pressure. So let's review. So far we've talked about Boyle's law, which is based on two variables. What are they? Volume and pressure, good. What is the relationship between volume and pressure? Good. And opposites, right? Inversely proportional. When one goes up, the other value goes down. And when we're talking about the lungs, there are three pressures we're concerned with. The pressure outside your body is known as what pressure?
Atmospheric.
Atmospheric, good. Inside your lungs, the pressure is called?
Intrapulmonary.
Good. And the pressure between your two pleural layers?
Intrapleural,
good. Which pressure must remain negative or less than atmospheric pressure to keep your lungs inflated?
Intrapleural.
Intrapleural, good. Okay, I think we're ready to talk about inhalation and exhalation. So we'll start with this picture here. Inhalation involves contraction of your muscles. What muscles contract in order for you to inhale?
Diaphragm and
external intercostals. We know the external intercostals are muscles between your ribs, and then of course the diaphragm sits underneath the base of your lungs. So when you've got those muscles contracting, your diaphragm pushes down and your intercostal muscles flare out your rib cage. When we do that, notice what happens to the volume in your thoracic cavity. Volume increases, okay? So once we increase the volume in your thoracic cavity, the intrapulmonary pressure will decrease. So let me draw in here our visceral and our parietal pleura just so we can have that conversation as well. Nicole, if you're cold, that thermostat's back on the wall. You're welcome to push it up.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Oh, this is excellent, isn't it? Thank you there. Okay, so we know atmospheric pressure is 760. Okay, so we're gonna keep that number in mind. 760 is what's outside your body at sea level. When your diaphragm and intercostal muscles contract, that causes an increase in volume in your thoracic cavity and a decrease in pressure. And specifically, it's the intrapulmonary pressure. I'll write really small down here just to keep us reminded that's intrapulmonary pressure we're talking about. So we don't have to go far. Let's say we're down to 758. If we drop our intrapulmonary pressure to 758, it's less than what's outside your body at 760. We know that air flows along a pressure gradient from high pressure to low pressure. This sounds familiar, right? Sounds like diffusion. Okay, things flow from high to low. Pressure and air gradients flow from high to low. So we're looking at air flowing from outside your body at 760 into your body where it's lower at 758. That's how you get air move into your body. It's just simply going to follow a pressure gradient and it sucks into your lungs. You don't hear it, you don't feel it, unless you have a problem with your respiratory system. but there's actually a suction or a vacuum that pulls that air into your lungs. The whole goal here is to equalize pressure with the outside world. So the driving force behind pulling your air into your lungs is this pressure gradient created here. Now, I did want to mention the intrapleural pressure. We know it's the pressure between your two pleura, and it's going to stay less than or negative to your intrapulmonary pressure. So toss a number out at me. What do you think that intrapleural pressure must be? 765? No, 760?
756.
That works. 756 works. Why does 756 work?
It's lower.
Yeah, it's lower than atmospheric, and it's lower than even that intrapulmonary. Good. So as long as your intrapleural pressure is less than atmospheric pressure, it's going to keep your lungs inflated. If it ever becomes greater than your atmospheric pressure, it puts a squeeze on your lungs, and it's like popping a balloon. You're going to force the air out, and the lung collapses. So 756, that's a good number for our intrapleural pressure. Okay. So let's hit this from the top. In order to inhale, your diaphragm and your intercostal muscles contract. That pushes your diaphragm down and flattens it out, and it flares out your rib cage. When you make your thoracic cavity bigger, you increase the volume in your thoracic cavity, and we automatically know the pressure is going to go where? Down. Good. So pressure decreases. It's now less than atmospheric pressure, and of course, this is a pressure gradient that makes you suck air in. So like a little vacuum cleaner, air moves into your lungs to equalize pressure. And everything's okay as long as your intrapleural pressure stays less than your atmospheric pressure. Once it becomes equal to atmospheric pressure or greater than, those lungs collapse. Okay, so that's what we have to keep in mind there.
Intrapleural pressure becomes greater or equal to.
Yeah, intrapleural pressure. If it's greater than or equal to atmospheric pressure, lungs will collapse. How about questions on inhalation?
So the pressure in the lungs, it never gets over the atmospheric?
It actually is. Intrapulmonary can be greater than atmospheric pressure, but that's going to make you exhale. It's going to force the air out.
Oh, okay.
Does the intrapleural pressure, it changes like with your intrapulmonary?
It does. It is always a few values less than. Yeah. So let me tie in something we're going to learn on the next page. In order for you to breathe in, a stimulus comes from your phrenic nerve. That comes from a respiratory center in your brain. The phrenic nerves are on both sides of your neck, and the phrenic nerve travels down to your diaphragm and intercostal muscles. And so there's a timing mechanism here. About every 5 seconds or so, that phrenic nerve fires an impulse, and so you repeat your breathing cycle about every 5 seconds. So that's what's going to initiate this process of inhalation. When the phrenic nerve stops firing off the nerve impulse, then there is nothing to tell your diaphragm and intercostals to stay contracted. So eventually, your diaphragm comes a dome-shaped muscle once again, and your intercostals between your ribs then relax, and your rib cage returns back to its normal size. Well, when you return all of that thoracic cavity space back to its normal size, look what happens to your volume. It's going to decrease. Anytime you decrease the volume in your thoracic cavity, what impact does this have on pressure?
Increase
pressure. Good. Which pressure specifically is inside your lungs?
Intrapulmonary,
right. So intrapulmonary pressure increases. Let's just say it's now 762. So what are you thinking? If, say, intrapulmonary pressure is 762 and outside your body is 760, how does the pressure gradient work that airflow? Goes from high inside to low outside, so it flows out of your lungs, and that's how exhalation works. So again, it's a pressure gradient created by what's happening with the muscles around your thoracic cavity. So even though your intrapulmonary pressure is 762, that intrapleural pressure may still be something like 758. So it's still less than or negative to your outside pressure. And that's critical, because if it equals atmospheric pressure, what happens to your lungs?
Collapse.
They collapse, yeah. So let's hit this story from the top. The respiratory center in your brain initiates the nerve impulse through your phrenic nerves. Your phrenic nerves travel through your neck, down to your intercostals, and down to your diaphragm. They fire off a nerve impulse that tells your diaphragm and your intercostal muscles to contract. What impact does that have on the pressure in your thoracic cavity? Pressure goes down and the volume in your thoracic cavity increases. Good. Why does the volume increase? You got more room. Yeah, your muscles contract, and that flares out your rib cage, and it pushes your diaphragm down. So that, in turn, will cause your pressure in your thoracic cavity to drop. Notice this value is less than atmospheric pressure. That tells me all I need to know. Pressure and airflow goes from high to low pressure. So do I inhale now or exhale? We inhale. How do you know? Good. Slower than the outside, so it's going from high to low pressure. Okay? And so down here, we're looking at intrapleural pressure. We'll notice that it's less than atmospheric pressure, which is good news, keeps us inflated. Okay? After about 2 or 3 seconds, your phrenic nerve stops receiving an impulse to fire. And so your diaphragm and intercostals relax. Notice how your diaphragm moves back up in a dome-shaped position. Your intercostal muscles relax, so your rib cage no longer flares. It returns to its normal position. So when we decrease the volume in your thoracic cavity, what impact does this have on your pressure? Increased pressure. So if pressure is now greater than your atmospheric pressure, what happens to airflow? Force it out, right. Now, I do want to mention that exhalation is a completely passive process. If you have a healthy respiratory system, there is no work required to exhale. All that happens is a pressure gradient changes, and now the air is forced out of your lungs. If you have something like emphysema and you have an obstructive disorder, you have to physically work to get the air out, and that requires ATP. So in those cases, we're going to see muscle wasting and changes to the shape of your thoracic cavity. But normally, exhalation's passive. This air flows from high pressure in your thoracic cavity to the outside world and where there's lower pressure. Okay, so the whole process is about 2 to 3 seconds to breathe in, about 2 to 3 seconds to breathe out. On average, we're looking at around a 5-second respiration cycle. And within a minute's time, that's somewhere between 12 and 15 to 12 and 18 breaths per minute. Okay, how you doing with this stuff? Do you have questions on it? Nicole?
So basically where it's high is going to the out, right? So if it's higher outside, it's going to move from high to low.
The air moves from high to low. So if I gave you guys on the test, if I said my atmospheric pressure is 770 and my intrapulmonary pressure is 760, what happens? You tell me that air moves in, you're inhaling. Okay, so you guys don't have to memorize the numbers here. I'll give you some numbers and ask you to predict what direction the air is going to flow.
It's going to move in because it's lower inside.
Lower inside, right. Any questions so far? Anything I can clarify for you? Okay. So I kind of like to show you this animation to appreciate what happens with the thoracic cavity. The diaphragm really does dome up on us when we're relaxed, and it does flatten down when it's contracted. So if you sing or if you talk a lot, then you'll notice that your diaphragm is almost feeling like it gives you a stomach ache, since it's pushing down on your stomach, which sits on the bottom side of your diaphragm. These intercostal muscles, when they contract, they do flare out your rib cage. I know that's kind of a strange thought to think about muscle contraction expanding an area, but in fact it will. It will expand your thoracic cavity space. If you need a clean and easy way to keep straight inhalation and exhalation, this is Respiratory 2 PowerPoint. You're welcome to grab the inhale and exhale slide off that PowerPoint. Down near the bottom of your page, I do want to mention that there are three things that influence respiration. One of those is called airway resistance. And you'll notice that the word resistance is something we've talked about before. We've talked about peripheral resistance. So peripheral resistance in the conversation around blood vessels was anything that slowed down blood flow through our vessels. So what do you think airway resistance is?
Slows down airflow,
yeah. So the simple fact that you have a wider trachea branch into smaller bronchi, even smaller bronchi, and even smaller bronchioles, and we keep getting smaller and smaller diameter, that in and of itself is going to cause a resistance to airflow. So the branching pattern here decreases the speed at which air can reach those inner portions of your lungs. Something tied to that is also surface tension. We know that water itself has surface tension, and there's water vapor all inside your lungs. Do you remember the name of the oily secretion that our lungs make to reduce surface tension?
Surfactant.
Surfactant, good. So surfactant plays a role here. That helps to decrease surface tension and help the air get into your lungs more effectively. Finally, lung compliance is how stretchy your lungs are. This is also how blood vessels work. If you're stretchy and you can recoil, then that is a healthier setup than having lungs that can stretch and don't recoil. So I always think about underwear and rubber bands here. If you've got old, worn-out underwear and it stretches and it doesn't pop back into position, that means that we have poor lung compliance. Thinking about these two processes, do you think poor lung compliance is more of an issue for inhalation or for exhalation?
Exhalation.
Why?
Got to
come back together, right? So inhalation, you can stretch it out, but you're right, you got to have the recoil ability to get the lungs to snap back in position. So if you lose lung compliance, as we do with emphysema, then we have trouble exhaling the air out. That's why it's an obstructive disorder. You have trouble getting the air out of those ruptured alveoli. All right, so that's a pretty heavy-duty page. Do you have any questions there on page 75? So we've actually talked about this already just a little bit. On page 76, we're going to talk about respiration control. So the control of respiration comes from a familiar place, and that is from your medulla oblongata and the pons. Those are both in the brain stem. Those are where we house an autonomic center, an automatic center, that involuntarily controls your respiration rate. Now, of course, very early in life when we learn to talk, we learn to override that respiration center. We know how to breathe and talk and manage all of that at the same time. But this center here manages respiration without any kind of voluntary override or any kind of voluntary control. You'll notice there's a set of phrenic nerves that come from that respiratory center. They innervate the diaphragm and the intercostal muscles. And this is going to dig back into your Bio-210 brain for just a moment. Do you remember the name of the plexus that serves the neck region?
Cervical.
Good. And the phrenic nerve is actually a piece of that cervical plexus in your neck. So it is going to come from your brain, through your neck, and then to the diaphragm and intercostal muscles. So oftentimes in the summertime, you hear about people diving into swimming pools or into a shallow lake, breaking their necks, and then dying as a result. And unfortunately, if medical care could be there very quickly, we might be able to save their lives. Quite often what happens is when someone dives into a shallow pool, they break the phrenic nerve connection through their neck. So the brain may be functional, and the diaphragm may be functional, but it's that connection in the neck that no longer can tell the diaphragm and intercostals to breathe. So that is the unfortunate problem that comes from being in a wreck or an accident, diving into a swimming pool, where you break that phrenic nerve connection. Okay, so the timing here is critical. The phrenic nerve turns on, it fires an impulse for about 2 seconds. What happens to your diaphragm and intercostals as a response? They contract. That contraction causes a change in your volume in your thoracic cavity. Do we increase or decrease volume?
Increase,
good. And if we increase volume, what happens to pressure in the thoracic cavity?
Increase.
Goes down and you breathe.
In,
yeah. So inhalation follows the firing of the phrenic nerve. After about 2 seconds, the phrenic nerve cuts off. The diaphragm and intercostals are no longer told to contract. And so what happens to them?
They relax.
They relax. What happens to the volume in your thoracic cavity?
Decreases.
Pressure will
increase.
And now, do you breathe in or out? Breathe out. Good. So exhalation follows. So like we were talking earlier, this is about a 5-second cycle. You breathe in for around 2 to 3 seconds. You exhale for around 2 to 3 seconds. And so this works out to be a normal respiration rate that works in about 12 to 15 or 12 to 18 breaths per second. We call this eupnea. Yeah, phrenic nerve, and then as a result, thoracic volume increases and pressure decreases. That's right. You know, we pretty much agree in most of our textbooks that 75 beats per minute is a normal heart rate. But for some reason, they can't seem to agree on what a normal respiration rate is. Some textbooks are going to tell you 12 to 15 breaths per minute. Some are going to tell you 12 to 18 breaths per minute. I believe the nursing program tells 12 to 18. So I just want to put that out there that I'm using our textbook's values, which is 12 to 15, but you may find in other resources 12 to 18. So I'll accept anything in that range, 12 to 15 or up to 18, as being a eupnea rate, a normal breathing rate. So notice the last bullet point there says expiratory neurons are inactive during quiet respiration. None of you are in here breathing heavy. And so if, however, we decided to run up and down the stairs in this building, we would find that we've got sternocleidomastoid, trapezius, the internal intercostals, all will assist us with breathing. So only if you need them, those expiratory neurons will kick on. Otherwise, they tend to stay quiet during normal respiration. Couple of other terms here. We've got dyspnea, which is difficulty breathing or shortness of breath. We also have apnea, which is easy to remember, A meaning without, so that's of course the absence of breathing. Hyperpnea is forceful breathing. So let me explain. We can all forcefully breathe on purpose. Over and over, right? Okay, and I can still maintain 12 to 15 breaths per minute, but I can do so forcefully. Now, hyperventilation is something different. That's in fact a rate change. So hyperventilation means breathing faster than 12 to 15 or 12 to 18 breaths per minute. So I want to emphasize that hyperpnea is forceful breathing, may not involve a rate change, but hyperventilation does involve a rate change. That's faster than our normal respiration rate. Okay, so this kind of gets us into some territory where we need to slow down and talk through this information. I want to mention there's some side effects of hyperventilation. Okay? And in order to appreciate what happens with hyperventilation, we need to talk about what's written on the board. Okay, and it is this equation here. So I wanted to tell you about something that may come as a surprise. Carbon dioxide is actually the number one stimulus for breathing. I think we always hear about how important oxygen is, and it is important. You can die without oxygen. But the number one stimulus that changes your respiration rate is actually carbon dioxide. Oxygen only becomes our primary stimulus when our oxygen levels drop to a critically low level. Our blood actually transports a reserve supply so that in case of exercise or emergency or sympathetic nervous system stimulation, you have an automatically built-in supply. But when you drop critically low, below 60 millimeters mercury, then oxygen becomes your primary stimulus. So when we talk about hyperventilation, you'll notice the equation here has nothing to do with oxygen. That's because oxygen is not the primary stimulus for breathing. It's carbon dioxide, okay? So I need to tell you a little bit about CO2. CO2 is transported in several ways in your bloodstream. It can be transported dissolved in your blood plasma. Blood plasma is a lot of water, okay? So when carbon dioxide is transported in the water of your blood plasma, those two chemicals react and they form this middle product called carbonic acid. Don't worry about carbonic acid. It's an unstable middle product. And we quickly dissociate into these two, hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions. This is how you maintain acid-base balance in your bloodstream. So, thinking way back to studying the pH scale, what influence will having excess hydrogens have on your blood pH? Lowers the pH, right. What if we get rid of a bunch of the hydrogen? Now what happens to your pH? Yeah, pH goes up, more alkaline. Okay, so something to think about, and now let's consider this. When you hyperventilate, what happens to your respiration rate? Breathe faster, right? Respiration rate goes up. So let's say that we're breathing faster. The faster you breathe, the more you remove CO2 from your bloodstream. So you're pumping out that CO2 as fast as you can make it. So we're gonna lose CO2 from our bloodstream. Does that make sense? Okay, so if I am really excited that I won some $400 million lottery, okay, panting like a dog, okay, that CO2 is leaving as fast as it can leave. That decreases everything across the board. You just told me that if we lose hydrogens, what happens to our blood pH? It goes up, so it becomes more alkaline. So here's what's gonna happen. The loss of CO2 is called hypocapnia. The loss of hydrogens is called alkalosis. So we know that breathing faster is going to cause chemical changes with your CO2 levels, but also it can cause chemical changes with your oxygen levels. The faster you breathe, the faster you bring oxygen back into your body. So what do you think happens to your oxygen levels when you hyperventilate? They go up, right. And so that can lead us to a condition called hyperoxia, meaning we've got excess oxygen levels in our bloodstream. Okay, on your worksheet there, hypocapnia is too little CO2. Respiratory alkalosis is too little hydrogen ions. And hyperoxia is excess oxygen. Sure. From the top there, hypocapnia is too little CO2. Respiratory alkalosis is too little hydrogen ions. And hyperoxia is excess oxygen. Okay. Oh, in an old version, I think I had it reversed. Okay. So several years ago, I was cooking dinner. I had frozen chicken breast, and I was impatient, wanting them to thaw quickly, and they were frozen together. I didn't want but one of the chicken breasts. They were frozen solid together. And so I ran them under hot water, and then I got the bright idea that taking a knife and wedging it between the two chicken breasts would be great, and that would wedge them apart quickly. Well, of course not, because the knife slipped and it cut through my finger. So I could see fatty tissue in there. It's oozing blood like nobody's business. So I had paper towel wrapped as thick as I could around my finger, and I thought, you know, what if I've cut through a tendon here or a ligament or something, and what if I've got permanent damage that needs surgery? And I'm driving down the street to the urgent care place with blood pumping through this huge wrapping of paper towel. You know, this is craziness, right? So I'm hyperventilating, and of course, that causes me to lose CO2. I'm heading into alkalosis, and I'm getting myself too much oxygen. Now, as a side story, anybody who's ever hyperventilated probably starts to feel tingly in your fingers and toes, and that has to do with this issue here, the exchange of hydrogen ions for calcium. The loss of calcium moving around in your cells is actually going to cause you to have that tingly feeling like you're going to pass out. So just wanted to mention that in case you've ever experienced that tingly feeling when you're hyperventilating. So nonetheless, why would handing me a paper bag have been a good solution? Get the CO2 back in the body, right? If I'm exhaling out too much CO2, if I put it back into my body, what will that do to my pH? Bring it back down, right? And so I shouldn't sit there forever with the bag on my face breathing. You should only do that until your respiration rate returns, and you said it, Anthony, back to normal. Yep, so that's the catch there is use a paper bag, restore your CO2 back into your bloodstream, and then do it until your respiration rate levels back off. What if you were to sit there with a paper bag breathing into it and your respiration rate was normal? You're right, you're putting too much carbon dioxide in your body, so you don't want to do it beyond having a normal respiration rate. Okay, so I want to emphasize here, this is cause and effect. If we hyperventilate, these are the changes you see in your bloodstream. You see too little CO2, you see alkalosis, and you see excess oxygen in transport. So that's a condition of three issues that we see arise from hyperventilation. Are you so far so good with this? Okay, let's talk about hypoventilation. Okay, so when we hyperventilate, we may purposely breathe slower. So if you're trying to do meditation or yoga or relax yourself, then breathing slower purposely is going to change your blood chemistry. Hypo as a prefix means slower. So the slower you breathe, what do you keep more of in your bloodstream? CO2. Yeah, that excess waste gas you're going to keep in your bloodstream. Okay, so if you think about it, the slower you breathe, the less opportunity you have to exhale out your CO2. That CO2 stays traveling in your bloodstream. The more CO2 you keep in your bloodstream, what impact does that have on your hydrogen ion concentration?
Makes it go up.
Hydrogens mean that your blood pH will go acid, yeah, more acidosis. So that's going to lead us to a condition of acidosis. And thinking about acidosis, that means our blood pH falls below 7 point what?
3.5,
right. And so if we start dropping below 7.35, now we're starting to have problems. And the slower you breathe, the less oxygen you pull in. What's that condition called? Hypoxia, right. So hypoxia. You'll notice here, at what point does hypoxia become a real serious problem for us?
60.
Yeah, 60 millimeters mercury. Normal is around 100, so that's a ways to fall there. 60 millimeters mercury is a very low oxygen saturation. So, yeah, 60 millimeters mercury is a critically low number. So the slower you breathe, the more CO2 you keep, the more acid your blood becomes, and the less oxygen you get into your bloodstream. Okay, does this stuff make sense so far? Do you have any questions or anything I can clarify for you? Let me emphasize once again, this is cause and effect. If I breathe faster, this is how I change my blood chemistry. If I breathe slower, this is how I change my blood chemistry. So I've got to keep in mind this is simply cause and effect. Hyperventilation produces these signs and symptoms. Hypoventilation produces these signs and symptoms. So it's not a compensation right now. All we're looking at is, if I breathe faster, then this is what it's going to do to my blood chemistry, okay? Now, what we're going to do is turn over to the next page and cause problems. So we're going to figure out how we can use our respiration rate to fix chemical problems in our bloodstream.
We have to know, like, is the CO2 plus H2O, like, on the tip, will you put that on here?
I don't have that on there.
Okay.
Yeah. Natalie. What is below 60 millimeters mercury of pressure? It is, the P is pressure, and of course oxygen O2. So yeah, PO2, it could be a big P, it could be a little P.
And that's for either the hypoventilation.
And it's really gonna be an issue for hypo. When you breathe too slowly, you're not likely gonna be hypoxic if you're hyperventilating. I want you to recognize the pattern. We've been here before. On page 77, you'll notice the stimulus. The chemoreceptors pick up on the chemical changes. They are in the same location, aortic arch and common carotid arteries. There's also chemoreceptors in your brain. You may recall the blood-brain barrier actually is missing from a few locations, so we can monitor blood pH in our brains if needed. And then the respiratory center makes a response. But I want you to notice it has nothing to do with sympathetic and parasympathetic stimulation, okay? So it is not the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems here that play a role. It is the phrenic nerve and its control of your diaphragm and intercostal muscles. And of course, the response is going to be either to hyperventilate or to hypoventilate, and then the change in blood chemistry comes from changing our respiration rate. So let me give you a couple of problems. We'll work through them together, and then I'll cut you loose to do some at the bottom of the page. So let's say that we're exercising, and exercise will cause an increase in CO2. If you increase your CO2, you're going to increase your hydrogen levels. Okay? So that is my problem. I've got increased CO2 and I've got increased hydrogen. What type of receptor picks up on my problem? Chemoreceptor, good. The respiratory center in the brainstem makes a decision. Does the respiratory center say we should breathe faster or slower?
Faster.
Breathe faster, yeah. So how is breathing faster going to help my problem? Exhale more CO2, get rid of that CO2, and then of course that will help to adjust my blood pH, all the while bringing in more oxygen. So that is the top row across. Respiration becomes faster when you need to get rid of CO2 and when you need to get rid of hydrogen ions. So in this case, we're using hyperventilation to fix a problem. So I know that when you exercise, you probably realize that you start breathing faster. The underlying reason for that is to get rid of your CO2 and, of course, to blow off those hydrogen ions. Let's do the bottom row there. The bottom row says any one of these. Let's take the antacids issue. Okay? So if you have somebody with a stomach ache who takes multiple antacids, those antacids will cause a condition known as alkalosis. So let's take a look here. If I breathe faster, is that going to help me with alkalosis? Make it worse, right? How would it make my situation worse? Releasing more hydrogens and making my blood pH go even higher, right? So why would I want to hypoventilate? Why would that be a better solution? Exhale less, hold on to your CO2. Why is keeping CO2 going to help adjust my blood pH? Keep those hydrogens, right. The more hydrogens we keep, the less alkaline our blood, and the more normal the blood pH adjusts back down to. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to cut you loose, let you work on practice problems 1 through 7 at the bottom of the page, and then we're going to do those together. Okay, so that's the bottom of page 77. All right, let's do answers. Okay, so the first question says, due to kidney failure, we have a buildup of hydrogen ions in the bloodstream. That leads us to a case of acidosis. Okay, so the acidosis is now my stimulus, and that's one of my problems here. And the way to fix this is to have the respiratory center in the brain make your phrenic nerve tell you to breathe faster. How does that help you? Good. Get rid of more CO2. That's going to adjust your pH back to normal. And, of course, bringing in more oxygen is going to be a side effect. Okay? So acidosis means that your blood pH is too low. And then the compensation is to breathe faster. Catch that? If you are in alkalosis, the compensation is to breathe slower. So they're going to work opposite to one another. That may be a way to help keep this straight. Breathe faster. Yeah, number one is breathe faster.
You said alkalosis, breathe slower.
Alkalosis, you're going to breathe faster in response. As a compensation, I should clarify, that's for a compensation. And if you're in alkalosis, your compensation is to breathe slower. That helps you retain more CO2. Yeah, don't use that if it's going to confuse you, because that's opposite to the cause and effect we have on the board. If you're alkaline, you'll breathe slower, yeah.
And that helps you retain more CO2.
Correct. The slower you breathe, the more CO2 you keep, and the more acid your blood becomes. Yeah, if that compensation stuff messes you up, if you got it figured out, then just ignore what I said. Yeah. Yeah, I'll give you a problem and have you work out.
Kind of like the other test where you just kind of solve them.
I'll have you tell me what the respiratory center does. Sure will.
Okay.
Kayla.
So are you always compensating for something?
Right now, most of us are probably not compensating, but the minute you all get up and walk out of here, your respiration rate's going to pick up and you're going to start compensating the minute you walk down that hallway. Yeah, so most of the time we're probably compensating in one way or another and don't really realize it, but if your respiration rate stays between 12 and 15 breaths per minute, then I would say you're not compensating during that time, but if it ever goes faster or slower, then yeah, you're probably compensating.
I like to ask
that. He's compensating, right. All of these are problems where you're compensating. In fact, let's do that number two. If you have an overdose of antacids are alkaline. That is my problem now. I've got an alkalosis condition. The way we know that, it says we've got too few hydrogen ions in the bloodstream, so the blood pH is now too high. How do I bring the blood pH back down?
Breathe less,
yeah. Hypoventilate. So what will that do for my CO2 levels? Increase my CO2, and what's the relationship between CO2 and blood pH?
Makes the blood more acidic,
exactly. So for number two there, how will the respiratory center compensate? Hypoventilate. You'll breathe more slowly and retain more CO2. Yeah, breathe slow and drop the pH. For number three, if you've got a case of mild hypoxia, that's our problem, right? Mild hypoxia, so too little oxygen. What will the respiratory center say we should do?
Hyperventilate,
exactly. So for number three there, if you've got mild hypoxia, you will hyperventilate. How does that help you? Get more oxygen, yeah, brings in more oxygen. Hyper, yep. You guys ever been to the mountains and felt like you were terribly out of shape? And you walk around, you go, God, nobody else up here is breathing like me, and I can't even get out of the car without, like, hyperventilating, and that's what it is. It's that hypoxia that you're compensating for. And so if you spent about a week or two up there, you'd probably start to accommodate because you'd make more EPO, and then you could transport more oxygen. But, yeah, if you go for the weekend to the mountains, you probably feel tired, you have to go take a nap, and then you hyperventilate everywhere you go. So not a very fun weekend, right? Okay, number four there, if you notice someone breathing quickly, hyperventilating, that is a compensation for what problem? Could be hypoxia, it could be... It could be maybe excess CO2, increased hydrogen, it could be acidosis. So any of those situations may lead you into a case where you hyperventilate. So his pH imbalance there must be an acidosis situation. Let's think about it this way. If he had alkalosis, why would breathing faster not be a solution? Right, you need to keep the CO2, get that pH back into a normal value, 7.35 to 7.45. Hyperventilation just makes you lose even more CO2, so that would not be a helpful goal for this one. Let's see, aspirin overdoses can cause overstimulation of the respiratory center. What do you think happens to our pH when we're overstimulated?
Increases.
pH increases, right, so you hyperventilate. you blow out too much what?
CO2.
Right. So the CO2 is being lost, and so it puts a person into a case of alkalosis. I feel like I've lost you guys on that one. Did I lose you on aspirin? Okay, so the catch here is if you overstimulate the respiratory center, instead of firing 12 to 15 times per minute, let's double it. Let's say we're 25 times per minute. So if you're breathing 25 breaths per minute, you're hyperventilating. Hyperventilation leads to problems like these, okay? So, or rather compensates for those problems, but it would lead to a loss of CO2. Yeah, the salicylic acid, but it actually cycles you through all four respiratory acid, metabolic alkaline acid, all four problems, which is kind of a crazy thing. All right, tell me about number six. What did you think was a good response for this problem? Hypoxemia.
Increased stimulation.
Good. Increased stimulation from the phrenic nerve. What happens to our respiration rate? Hyperventilation. Good. Number six is hyperventilation. Finally, number seven says if we smoke and that contains carbon monoxide, that will decrease our amount of oxygen in the bloodstream. How do you think the respiration rate will change?
Hyperventilation.
Correct. Six and seven are both hyper.
And you said on five that aspirin overdose, what blood pH amounts, it raises the hydrogen ions. It's acidic. Did you say?
It'll lead you to alkalosis.
Alkalosis.
Yeah. Why don't we practice some more of these on Monday? Y'all have a good weekend. I will. Yep.